This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from the City University of New York, Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman at University of California and a lot of DayQuil.
Our guest is Cristobal Young from Cornell University.
Hi there.
Hi, Cristobal.
Today, pyramid schemes. Our discussion was recorded on Wednesday, April 17th, 2019.
So I've got an item. Yesterday, as we record this, I got to the Valley way early for a meeting. And so I was hanging out at a Starbucks for 90 minutes. Mm. And sitting down right at the same time I was at the next table, there was two couples, both in their 20s. Mm. And one of the couples was pitching the other couple on what was very obviously some type of scam. Mm. Involving a lot of talk of, you know, self-empowerment and rags to riches and all that sort of thing. And I would have preferred to just tinker with my R code, which is why I had my ThinkPad with me. But I had left my headphones, and so I had no choice but to be distracted. And so I tweeted, left my headphones at home, and now I can't concentrate on my work at the Starbucks because at the table next to me, someone's being recruited in some kind of financial management cult, a lot of what Freddie and Sarah taught me. And somebody, let me give credit, Timothy Ogden said, live tweets, please. And so I ended up live tweeting the whole 90-minute encounter as eavesdropped on it. And you know, it got a certain amount of attention, and it was just a fascinating thing. And about halfway through, I discovered that it was a combination of Worldwide and Amway, where, you know, you have Amway as a multi-level marketing organization. And then apparently on top of that, you have this fleas upon fleas thing, where there's something called Worldwide, which basically sells you pep talks on how to be a more aggressive Amway salesperson. and it was just fascinating. I mean, it was horrifying, but it was also fascinating. Yeah. And, you know, I've read, you know, when I was in grad school, I read Nicole Woolsey Biggert's Charismatic Capitalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm broadly aware of how these things work. But it was just really interesting and horrifying to watch people get pitched on it. And, one of the things that was interesting is there was nothing about the actual products. I didn't hear one word about like a particular, SKU item. You know, there was nothing about like, oh, this is the hot selling item, and most customers like the lipstick more than they like the foundation, but you know, or whatever, anything like that, right? It wasn't about the products. It was all about the culture of sales and self-empowerment and, you know, the dreams of riches and stuff like that, which really made it obvious that it was a pyramid scheme, not the world's most inefficient model of retail.
What was being sold ultimately? So it was sort of like, it was like a self-improvement type of, would you characterize it as like a self-improvement cult that was the true product underlying this, or?
The true product being sold was that you can get rich.
Exactly.
So their conversation started by talking about how there were various people who'd gotten fabulously wealthy through this system. And, you know, there were some stories about so-and-so who's a little bit higher up than me in the movement. You know, he has a boat and I bought all this stuff for you guys, so you know the dream is real. I bought this boat to take all my team leaders so they can see what the program makes possible. And then, yeah, but, you know, it's one of those things where it's like when you're in it, you don't need a word for it. You know, fish don't have words for water. So, you know, and then she interjected, he's unbelievable, you know. So, and then she told a story about, you know, so-and-so, this young woman, you know, she retired at 26 and, you know, she saw her husband, they went to a farm and she saw her husband like a horse. So she just bought it for him because she could afford it, you know. And I asked her, what does she do all day? And she's like, I don't even know. I just go to the gym and, you know, I just do whatever I want. And it's like, that could be your lifestyle, you know. So it was very much selling the idea of you could be fabulously rich. But right before this, the Marx, who were pretty well sold on this already, but, you know, they still were the people who were lower level, and therefore I think it's fair to refer to them as Marx and the higher level people as cons. They were telling a story about how their car had just gotten repossessed, And the cons were telling him, like, oh, don't, you know, just ignore the collection agency people because you're already going to have bad credit and you can totally repair bad credit anyway. And what can they do from you? They already repossessed the car. Concentrate on building your dreams.
Hmm. It seems like really terrible advice, just for the record.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I was looking forward to, you know, this kind of expert analysis. I figured I could look at from my fellow economic sociologist to understand household finance and everything like that. See, I was thinking it was a good idea. I was thinking about email. If only we also had Fred Wary. Go ahead, Leslie.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's really interesting, right? Because did I ever tell you all about when my dad decided he was going to be an Amway salesman? True, but sad. True, but sad. Like, for about a year, of my adolescence, my dad, like, was like, okay, I'm going to do this Amway thing. It's this way for me to make this money, and I have a full-time job, but this stuff sells itself. Yeah. And I remember my brothers and I, we were all in middle school. And like, my dad at that point in time was a single parent. So, you know, like one of the things that that seems to also like be the same with the other is it's like these marks are at this certain point of vulnerability, right? And you know, it's like single parent, I got three kids. I don't know what I'm going to do. And this person said, this stuff sells itself, right? Mm. And I remember my brothers and I being like, who the hell is going to pay for these vitamins? Right? And, and then my father, to his credit, like, you know, it took him a year to, like, realize, okay, fine, we're just going to use this shit ourselves, okay? Mm. I mean, this is not what I thought it was going to be.
And it's unsellable.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is like my father, you know, this, you know, highly educated, like supposedly very rational, like uber rational man, like being pulled into this thing, like during a moment of extreme desperation, right? It's like all of a sudden I'm like a single parent. Like, I wasn't an active parent, when my parents were together. Now I have to deal with the three of you. What do I do? Oh, this easy shit sounds good, right? It'll sell itself and I don't have to. And to his credit, he was able to be like, okay, that was not a good decision, but we can at least use some of this stuff. But I wonder, like, the average, like, how long does it take the average, like, recruit to come to an understanding that, okay, like, it's a pyramid scheme because some people get to be at the top, right? And then those of us at the bottom never get anything.
Yeah, so one thing that's interesting you said is this stuff sells itself. I actually didn't hear any of that in the meeting that I eavesdropped on. The emphasis was not on the product. Like I said, they never mentioned the actual product. Yeah. And it was like, 40 minutes, I never found out what the product was. And it was only like 40 minutes into their conversation that I found out who the vendor was. And I would have to look it up to find out what they were selling. The product is you.
Yeah.
You're the product, you know, and not just in the sense of you're the mark and you're the real product, but in the sense of what you're being pitched is that it's all about you and your self-actualization and your energy and your potential. And they were selling them much less on the cons were selling the marks, much less on here are the products that you can sell to customers, and much more on the idea of here are a bunch of seminars you need to attend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you attend the seminars, it will basically give you the kind of emotional energy to go out there and sell.
Oh, that sounds like, you know, what's the name of those people?
Trump University.
No, the people, them, but also the Tom Cruise people. What are their names?
Scientology. Scientology is basically, you know, a self-help cult.
What were you going to say, Cristobal?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had an experience of this a long time ago, just for recreational purposes, really. My parents, also via my parents, as with Leslie, but my parents had just sort of become friends with this person who was, and he pitched them on one of these multi-level marketing things, and they didn't go for it, but they thought it was a great pitch. Mm. And, you know, I was in college at the time and I was really interested in the economy. And they were like, you know, you would find this really interesting. We should bring him over again just so you can hear the pitch. And so, you know, I was definitely came into it like.
Did he have to sign an IRB form before giving you the pitch?
Nah, the good old days. You just try stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, cowboy sociology.
Old town road sociology.
Nobody signed off on this. Did it. Yeah.
But what was it? What was the, first of all, was it convincing? Was it like, what were they doing?
It was very well done. It was definitely a great presentation. It was just some guy. And basically the whole thing, it wasn't about any, you know, training you were going to get. It wasn't, you know, about the product that you were going to sell. It was totally like, okay, this, what we're going to do here is just sit down and spend half an hour thinking about your ideal life. What is a good life for you from a consumer perspective? Like, what kind of car do you want in your driveway? You know, what's your favorite restaurant? How often do you want to eat out in a restaurant? Hmm. Let's do 30 minutes of like 100 questions to define your ideal lifestyle, and then we'll figure out what it costs. And it really, I mean, I had a lot of fun with this guy. I'm like, yeah, I want the Jaguar in the driveway, definitely. And you know, so at the end we really came up with a number that was absurdly high. Mm. And you could see the guy sort of realized like, oh, there's no way we're going to be able to pay for this, but you know, we'll still go with this idea, but it gets you caught up. He's doing a great job of trying to get you caught up in, I need more money to have this awesome consumerist lifestyle. And then he's like, okay, so let's sign you up to sell Tupperware to your friends. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, this
That's
is the plan?
Buy a Porsche.
So how many 75 cent per container commissions would it take?
That's a lot of snack packs.
but that's why it's a pyramid scheme, right? It's because there's no way that you can make a significant amount of money on, you know, a 50 cent commission for, a storage container. The only way to make money is by signing up other people to sell, or realistically to buy inventory in the hopes of selling it. It ends up in everyone's garage.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's kind of like the precursor to the business model of like Facebook, right? I mean, it's like, it's not just about like these ads that we have. Like, this isn't what makes us money. What makes us money is us being able to be like, oh yeah, you get this free access, and then we get to sell you, right?
That one of the basic ideas in marketing is that you project an image of the person's idealized self, and then you provide the product merely as a conduit for it. It's a means to an end. When you told that story, it reminds me of when I was teaching. I taught marketing at Temple University before coming here.
Oh wow!
And I remember there was, I think it's Philip Kotler's Principles of Marketing, where there's like a whole page that's talking about how exciting it is that marketing research is now using sociologists to learn how cults form, because then we can use that information to build brand commitment. And it's a little bit like how, the makers of Candy Crush hired addiction specialists.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just a shame that, these pretty desperate people were, hoping to not just get out of their, precarious circumstances and raise themselves up to wealth by something as insane as joining a multi-level marketing scheme, when they could have done something sensible, like go to college and get a degree in sociology, where you can do anything you want in sociology. Think about all the dreams you have in sociology. And what's really exciting is you should go to graduate school, and then you can teach sociology to other people.
That's surreal. You know what? That's a great point. Like, Are we really all that different? If you're a social department who says behind the scenes, I don't care about jobs, this is an intellectual endeavor, and then when the students come in and you go, oh, there's lots of exciting jobs that you can do, as if like you were thinking about it or designing a curriculum for that, or if you're bringing in a bunch of tuition-paying doctoral students saying, you could be a faculty member, be a professor.
Wait, where do you charge tuition to doctoral students?
There are a lot. Do you know how many doctoral programs are in the United States?
I mean, terminal master's programs generally charge tuition, but
no.
Some doctoral programs charge.
I would wager the majority
our programs fund the students, you know, to a considerable amount, but that's not the point. The point is, like, there's a huge overproduction of social science and humanities PhDs, and nobody is being honest with students about this.
Yeah.
You know, we do recruitment, and we you know, we're trying to recruit the best students, and we pitch them on the best possibility, the best possible outcome.
Yeah.
And we don't talk to them. We never talk to them about, like, well, most people who come through the program actually don't become professors. You should realistically know that.
Totally.
It just doesn't happen.
You know, and you're hiring very high potential young people for what is basically like a 4-year, 20K per year contract.
Yeah, it's a winner take all market. I mean, that's a huge part of the problem, right?
Yeah.
But are we running a similar scheme in this business or?
No, we are. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like academia, like, it is like a winner-take-all market, like, in many ways. It's like, okay, fine. So you've got these goods, like, and the goods are like, you know, let's say you got 15, 20 students who come into a given cohort, and, like, mm-hmm. you already decided, okay, somebody has ranked them in some way, and you're like, okay, fine. Like, this is number one, or, like, this is number two. And you know what? And like, you think about it, you're like, yeah, you know, some of them are, like, some people are better than others in some way. But in terms of the rewards that you get for being number one, like, versus the rewards that you get for being number four, when yeah. the difference between one and four is so incredibly slight, it's messed up.
Yeah. You know what I think of it as is, I think our business really is a lot more like the music business
yeah.
or like the fiction writing business than we care to admit. And, you know, the differences between our graduate programs and there are graduate programs, master's degrees in operatic singing,
mm-hmm.
you know, like talk about a job market that's almost completely dead.
Yeah.
We're not so different from them. We're not as different from them as we think.
As we imagine, yeah. And I mean, you know, linking it back to these sort of multi-level marketing things, I mean, it's definitely, when I was applying to grad school and thinking about becoming a professor, I definitely had this like idealized life of, wow, being a professor, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is great, but, you know, they didn't program me with this vision of what would be a great career. I brought it, but the grad programs are definitely sort of taking advantage of the fact that there's many students who have this idealized vision of what being a professor, like a life of intellectual introspection, you know, it just sounds, you know, fantastic. And we just sort of like, cool, you want that? Well, we're your pathway.
Yeah.
You know, we can provide that to you.
Yeah.
And there's not like the realistic assessment of like, well, how many can we actually provide that to?
No, I think that's a great distinction. Yeah.
We're selling non-pecuniary consumption,
yeah.
right? We're selling not the idea that you'll become fabulously wealthy because yeah. realistically, you know, faculty at top departments make a solidly upper middle class living, but nobody's rich. Like
yeah.
even the most highly compensated social scientists, like let's say, I don't know, Roland Fryer or somebody, he makes good money, but he's not like rich, rich.
That's because he's under investigation. That's why.
First of all, the Pew Research Center asked Americans what they considered to be rich. And I believe more than half of the respondents said $150,000 per year salary or less.
Ooh.
So in the eye of the beholder, rich.
No, I agree with that, but we're not talking about the kind of like
millionaires, people making $1 million a year or more that, you know, one of us might study.
Yeah, we're not talking about super elite.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not like I get to go to this strip club and just like shove the undies full of hundreds.
Because that's what we would all be doing if we made $1 million a year or more.
Exactly, right? I mean, come on.
Pass the sanitizer.
I really don't get, like, you hear stories about industries where people take, you know, business partners who are coming in for a visit or people they're recruiting for jobs to strip clubs. I think we talked about this with the John Jay College issue, something like that. And it's like, yeah. I can't even imagine, like, let's say that Queens College or Georgetown was trying to poach me. And Leslie or Joe took me to a strip club. I would run.
What are you talking about? If it was one of us, like we'd be like sitting back and being like, okay, so what do you think this symbolizes? I mean,
well, yeah, no, but I would just be like, what the hell kind of place is this that they're taking me here? But apparently there's industries where that works, you know.
Yeah.
It's like expected business hospitality.
No, choice smoked meat locations is my trick of the trade.
Oh yeah, you take me to a barbecue. No, it's not gonna be Brooklyn barbecue. So
it's taken over the world, Gabe.
Whatever. There's no really such thing.
We're so distractible, but Gabriel's point was, you know, the thing, the big multi-level marketing scam in academia is not you're going to get super rich, but you're going to have this idealized intellectual life, non-pecuniary aspects of a career that really drive people and is really inaccessible. And we,
yes. Although don't fool, like in my opinion, in the eyes of the majority of society, our lifestyle is rich in their eyes. I mean,
yeah, that's a good point too.
Oh, I'm not complaining. I would say that I make a very good living and I have a nice lifestyle. I'm just saying I'm not rich, you know, and I'm not saying that as a complaint, you know.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if it's the majority of society, because let me tell you something. Like you talk to your students. I remember this one student went on this whole like harangue about how, yeah, I mean, because just you guys are just so smart, but you just don't get paid really well, like in class. And I was like, how do you know how much I get paid? And she was like, because you're a teacher. And I was like, do you not, like, most people don't understand, right, that there's a distinction. Like, I was like, yeah, I do this labor, but then I'm also meant to do this other labor, right?
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying I get paid extremely well for it, but don't cry for me, Argentina, right. You know?
I mean, an undergraduate at Georgetown, I don't think is representative of like the median American.
The general population.
Yeah. She was like, you poor serf.
Yeah, exactly. Have a coin. Good madam. Buy yourself a loaf of bread.
Well, that's the thing. She didn't offer me any coin. So, yeah. I mean.
But as a rich person, I'd like to give you some advice.
She's like, just so you know, professor, I value you, even though others don't.
It's condescending as hell.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Cristobal Young from Cornell. His book is The Myth of Millionaire Tax Flight, How Place Still Matters for the Rich, with Stanford University Press. We're on the web, sociocast.org/annex, on Twitter @SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.